Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, everyone. Stakuyi here.
And I'm Gabby.
And we are the hosts of History of Everything, a podcast which you can probably guess by the name is, well, I mean, it's about everything. Do you want to know why people thought potatoes were evil and would give you syphilis? Are you curious about all the stories of the terrible and stupid ways that people have kicked the bucket over the years? Do you want to hear tales about all of the different badasses of history and the lives that they had brought to life? Well, if so, then look no further. History of Everything is just the right podcast for you. It's available on Spotify, Pandora, and anywhere else that you get your podcast from. Join us for some fun and just see how weird and wacky history can be.
Jimmy wasn't the kind of guy to take retirement easy. At 62, he was out of the job he'd held for much of his adult life, and he was looking for his shot at getting back in. He knew it was going to be a tough fight ahead, but Jimmy also wasn't the kind of guy to ever back down from a fight. On July 30th, 1975, Jimmy started his morning the way he always did. He got up, did 30 push-ups, followed by a breakfast of toast, grapefruit, tea, and two soft-boiled eggs. He made some phone calls to some of his business allies and got caught up on the latest news. For a little while, he puttered around his summer cottage at Big Square Lake, about 40 miles away from Detroit. He then told his wife, Josephine, that he had a late lunch meeting scheduled for 2 p.m. At noon, Jimmy changed into blue slacks and a blue pullover shirt. He put on his sunglasses and got behind the wheel of his green 1974 Pontiac hardtop coupe. His meeting was set for an upscale restaurant called the Maccas Red Fox in Bloomfield Township. He still had some time to kill, so he stopped off at an airport limousine service where he was a secret investor. His partner was out to lunch, though, so he spent some time chatting with some of the employees. The guys he talked to said Jimmy seemed nervous. Sometime between 2:15 and 2:30, Josephine received a phone call from a frustrated-sounding Jimmy, telling her the person he was supposed to meet for lunch stood him up. Jimmy told his wife that he'd be home by 4 o'clock, after which he'd grill some steaks for dinner. But that was the last time Josephine ever heard from Jimmy. By late that evening, Jimmy still hadn't come home and Josephine was getting worried. She phoned a couple of friends to come over and stay with her. By the following morning, with still no word from Jimmy, she was on the verge of tears. She called her 34-year-old son James in Traverse City and her 37-year-old daughter Barbara Kranzer, who lived in St. Louis. Both of Josephine's children rushed home to be with their mother. By 8 a.m., the Bloomfield Township Police Department was informed of Jimmy's disappearance. It wasn't long before officers found Jimmy's abandoned Pontiac in the restaurant parking lot. They opened the trunk, halfway expecting to find Jimmy's body inside, only it was empty. They also spoke to some witnesses who said Jimmy came in and got his usual table that day. He waited around for his lunch guests to arrive, but he never did. Irritated, he dropped a $20 bill on the table. Then he went across the street and used a payphone at a nearby hardware store to phone his wife. Not long after, Jimmy was spotted talking to some men who pulled up in a maroon sedan. Then Jimmy got inside, and the car drove off. After that, no one ever saw Jimmy again. That evening, on July 31st, missing persons case number 753425 was opened in the name of James Riddle Hoffa, better known as Jimmy Hoffa. What happened to the former president of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters has gone down in history as one of the greatest unsolved mysteries ever. I'm Nate Hale, coming to you live from 6 feet beneath the end zone inside Giants Stadium, and this is The Conspirators.
Thank you.
The name Jimmy Hoffa has become the stuff of legend. At the time of Hoffa's disappearance, he had the backing of many of the truckers and other working-class people who belonged to the 2-million-member Teamsters Union in his comeback fight. In 1971, Hoffa was paroled after serving a 5-year stint in a federal penitentiary for jury tampering and mail fraud. Ever since, he'd been taking steps to regain his former post as the president of the Teamsters. But there were a lot of powerful people who did not want to see Hoffa in charge of the powerful Teamsters Union again. This included high-ranking members of organized crime, the FBI, and very possibly the President of the United States. But these threats didn't rattle Hoffa. The man loved a good fight. His entire reputation was built around his toughness and his willingness to stand up to anyone. He once summed up his strategy for victory by saying, "I do to others what they do to me, only worse." But Hoffa was more than just a fighter. He was also a shrewd labor leader who managed to turn a loose collection of truckers and warehouse workers into an enormously powerful national organization. He was beloved by his fellow Teamsters, feared and respected by others, and he'd even developed a good working relationship with many people in management. Along with being a tough and formidable leader, Hoffa was also known to be kind and generous, an adoring father and husband, and a great friend to have. Hoffa was also a person who knew how to get things done. This meant allying himself with some very powerful people in organized crime. But in doing so, Hoffa's stubborn belief in his own invulnerability would ultimately lead to his downfall. James Riddle Hoffa was born into a working-class Pennsylvania Dutch-Irish family on February 14, 1913, Valentine's Day, in the small town of Brazil, Indiana. He was the third of 4 children, and a complete surprise. The town doctor originally told his mother the swelling in her belly was probably a tumor. It turned out that tumor was actually a healthy baby boy. Jimmy Hoffa's father, John, was a big, cheerful man who worked across western Indiana prospecting for coal. He died when Jimmy was 7 from black lung disease. Back then, there were no labor protections for coal miners, and a lot of men like Jimmy Hoffa's father died because of it. After her husband's death, in order to support the family, Jimmy's mother, Viola, took jobs cleaning houses and waitressing in a restaurant. Jimmy and his older brother, Billy, hunted and fished in order to put food on the table. They also hustled odd jobs for cash. One day, about a year after their father died, the two boys were given the chore of killing a chicken for dinner. Jimmy's job was to hold the bird steady while his big brother chopped the head off with an axe. Only Billy slipped and instead brought the axe down on Jimmy's right hand, slicing it open from his knuckles to his wrist. Doctors thought Jimmy might never fully regain the use of that hand again. But Jimmy stubbornly refused to listen. Instead, he fought off the pain and kept exercising that hand until he finally regained full use of it. When Jimmy was 11, his mother moved the family to Detroit, where she got a good job polishing car radiator caps in a Fisher Body Fleetwood plant. The family lived in a working-class neighborhood among the Polish residents who saw the Hoffas as outsiders. Jimmy and his brother often got into scraps with the local boys. Jimmy was bright and did okay in his classes, but he still quit school in 1927 at age 14 because he wanted to step up and be a man and bring home some money for the family. He started out making $12 a week, working 60 hours a week inside a department store. 2 years later, after the Great Depression hit, many of Hoffa's former co-workers at the department store were forced to rummage for food inside garbage cans. Luckily, Jimmy managed to keep his job. Even still, it remained difficult to feed the family. There were days where they would count it as a luxury when he was able to bring home enough money to afford slathering a little lard on a piece of bread and sprinkling it with salt and pepper. A friend told him that if he wanted to eat, he should try getting a job in the food business. So in 1929, Jimmy Hoffa got a job unloading produce from railroad cars for Kroger's grocery chain. By that point, he had grown to his maximum height of 5 feet 1.5 inches tall, which wasn't particularly big, but Hoffa was also strong for his size. This was something a lot of neighborhood tough guys found out the hard way. The job for Kroger's was even harder than it was working at the department store. Jimmy's boss was a tyrant, and the working conditions were miserable. At age 18, Jimmy helped organize his first strike among the 175 warehouse workers. At the time, strikes were illegal in Michigan, but Hoffa waited until a carload of highly perishable strawberries arrived. Then he and his co-workers refused to work. Jimmy's boss was furious, but he still gave in to their demands in less than an hour. After this, Jimmy's guys received a new contract that gave the men a 13-cent hourly pay raise, a guaranteed half day of work each day, a modest insurance plan, and recognition of their union, the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. The Teamsters were impressed with young Jimmy Hoffa, and they began grooming him to take on a larger role in the organization. Within a year of the strike, Jimmy was working as a union organizer. The Teamsters were founded in 1903 to represent the men who drove horse-drawn livery wagons, but this soon expanded to include chauffeur and stableman, and eventually warehouse workers. Even still, by 1932, the union only counted 78,000 workers among its ranks, most of which were concentrated in Detroit and Chicago. Individual locals were still relatively small and lacking in resources. Local 299 was Jimmy's group. At the time he started, the local only had about 300 members, few of whom could afford to pay their union dues. Making matters even worse, at the time, many employers used armies of hired goons, including members of organized crime, and even working police officers to bust heads on the picket lines. During this time, Jimmy Hoffa gained a reputation as someone who wasn't to be trifled with. He was more than willing to go in with his fists swinging. He was arrested at least 24 times. During 1 year alone, Hoffa had his scalp stitched together no fewer than 6 times. The cops and their billy clubs were bad, but Jimmy knew the mob muscle could be even worse. On more than one occasion, he was ambushed by guys threatening to straight up murder him. Once, a strikebreaker at a picket line outside a Detroit tobacco company actually shot Jimmy's brother Billy by mistake, thinking he was Jimmy. Billy survived, but the violence continued into the night, including rock throwing and firebombing. But eventually, the tobacco company gave in to the union's demands. In 1936, Jimmy met and married 17-year-old Josephine Posawak after a 4-month courtship. Meanwhile, Jimmy continued to rise to the ranks in the union, having gained a reputation as a guy who got things done. One of the ways Jimmy managed to do so was by striking up relationships with some of the city's most powerful organized crime figures. Early on, Jimmy managed to get the goons who the business owners were paying as strikebreakers to back off and take a neutral stance in the fight. Officially, the union leadership didn't approve of the members having any association with organized crime. But unofficially, they loved the results Jimmy Hoffa was able to achieve by making friends in some rather shady places. Jimmy wasn't only organizing business owners, but rival unions as well. During the 1940s, the Congress of Industrial Organizations began luring many of the Teamsters members away. This led to a series of vicious fights between the unions. During these battles, a number of skulls were cracked and at least one man was killed. Jimmy could see that his Teamsters were outmanned and at risk of losing this war, so he turned to mob leaders Angelo Melli and Santo Perone for help. The mobsters used every intimidation tactic at their fingertips to scare individual truck drivers into joining the Teamsters. Within a year, the CIO abandoned Detroit and left it to Jimmy's union. From then on, Jimmy often continued to work with the Detroit mob to grow the Teamsters union and cement their reputation as a force to be reckoned with. In 1938, Jimmy's daughter Barbara was born. Then, 3 years later, he welcomed his son James into the world. Jimmy also acknowledged two other people as being practically members of the family: his old girlfriend Sylvia Pagano and her son Chucky O'Brien. Pagano had been married to a man named Sam Scaradino, who sometimes went by the alias Frank O'Brien. He had been a driver for a minor gangster. After O'Brien committed suicide, Pagano returned to Detroit, where she got married and was widowed a second time. She struck up her friendship once again with her old sweetheart, Jimmy Hoffa. Her young son, Chucky, would come to refer to Jimmy as Dad. There are those who have speculated that Jimmy may have been the boy's actual father, although there has never been any evidence to back this up. It was through Pagano that Hoffa struck up another critical friendship with her current flame, Anthony Tony Jack Jackalone. Hoffa considered Tony Jack a good friend, although the friendship would eventually sour and many people believe may have ultimately led to Hoffa's disappearance and presumed murder. As Hoffa continued to build his empire, he was elected president of Local 299 in 1945. During that same period, he developed a sideline in mob-style shakedowns. His first arrest in 1940 was for extortion, and there were still more to come. In 1946, Hoffa was indicted on charges that he and some of the gangster associates were using non-union truckers to pay thousands of dollars to the Teamsters. In exchange, the Teamsters turned a blind eye to the non-union truckers. These charges were eventually reduced to a misdemeanor, and Hoffa got off with a simple fine. This was a pattern that would repeat itself over time. Charges had a way of not sticking to Jimmy Hoffa, and he gained a reputation as being practically invulnerable over time. In 1946, he became the head of the Joint Council overseeing five Detroit area locals. He also became a negotiating chairman for the Central States Drivers Council, which covered Teamsters in 12 Midwestern states. Hoffa would go on to become the spokesman for approximately 650,000 Teamsters across the central and southern U.S. During this period, he set up a health and welfare fund for his people, which grew rapidly through member contributions. He also set up a welfare fund for Michigan Teamsters, but instead of using a traditional bank to manage these funds, Jimmy instead turned to Paul Red Dorfman, an associate of mob boss Santo Perone. Dorfman had also once been a top figure in the Chicago mob founded by Al Capone. Within a few years, Dorfman was raking in millions of dollars in commissions, funneling money back to the mob. In 1952, Jimmy Hoffa was elected one of nine Teamster vice presidents at the union's national convention. Although Jimmy officially stood ninth in line, everyone regarded him as the right-hand man of the then newly elected Teamsters president, Dave Beck. By throwing his full support to Beck, Hoffa was granted practically unlimited authority throughout the central and southern United States. But Hoffa's rapid ascension through the union's ranks also brought him to the attention of some very powerful people in the United States government. In 1951, Senator Estes Kefauver's Special Committee to Investigate Organized Crime in Interstate Commerce began looking at Teamsters Local 985 in Detroit for its alleged mob ties. The 985's president was a man named William Bufalino, who was a nephew by marriage to mobster Angelo Melli. According to Kefauver's investigation, the Local 985 was embroiled in a scheme to extort millions of dollars from non-union jukebox distributors. Jimmy Hoffa was summoned before the committee to testify. It was then they discovered that Hoffa had routinely been instructing the union to destroy all financial records each year, allegedly to save storage space. But this suspicious activity put Hoffa on the government's radar. Jimmy Hoffa, along with Red and Alan Dorfman, were all ordered to testify. Between the three of them, they took the Fifth Amendment against self-incrimination a total of 135 times.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course, you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
They've done weird things. Cat and Jethro, box of oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the box of oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
Rumors of dirty dealings inside the Teamsters Union made their way to the press. A labor columnist and radio commentator named Victor Riesel began to make waves by accusing the Teamsters of being in collusion with organized crime. In 1956, someone threw acid into Riesel's face as he walked out of a Manhattan restaurant, blinding him. Jimmy Hoffa reportedly responded by saying how he regretted the acid didn't just blind the man, but it should have gotten in his hands he used to type with as well. Police arrested a New York mobster named Johnny Diagardi, better known as Johnny Dio, as the mastermind behind the acid attack on Riesel. But the charges were quickly dismissed after witnesses refused to testify against him. Hoffa and Dio were well acquainted and were known to be doing business together. In 1952, Dio and Hoffa met at the annual Teamsters Convention. By that point, Hoffa was looking to control the National Union, and he wanted more sport in New York. So he and DiAgardi invented 7 new Teamsters locals there. Even though these locals had no official members, only officials who were part of Dio's organization. Together, these locals gave Hoffa enough votes to seize control of the council governing New York's 125,000 Teamsters. By 1956, New York's Teamsters were all in Jimmy Hoffa's pocket. Word of Hoffa's power play in New York made its way to Washington, D.C. This time, Hoffa came under the scrutiny of the Senate Select Committee on Improper Activities in the Labor or Management Field, chaired by Senator John L. McClellan. At the time, the chief counsel for that committee was a young, wealthy lawyer from Massachusetts named Robert F. Kennedy. His older brother, Senator John F. Kennedy, was also a committee member. This was the beginning of an intense feud between the Kennedys and Hoffa that would rage on for years. The first time Bobby Kennedy met Jimmy Hoffa face-to-face was at a dinner party in 1957, hosted by the Teamsters, in the hope that the two men could work out their differences amiably. But Hoffa and Bobby Kennedy had an instant dislike for one another. At one point early on, Bobby challenged Hoffa to an arm wrestling match. Hoffa later said that he let Bobby strain for a few minutes before he slammed Kennedy's knuckles down hard on the table. Kennedy, red-faced and knuckles swelling, got up and stomped out of the room before they even ate dinner. But Kennedy got Hoffa back. 6 days before the encounter, John Chiesty, a lawyer and investigator with the Internal Revenue Service, had gone to Kennedy, telling him that Hoffa had tried to bribe him. Hoffa offered Chiesty $18,000 to get himself a job on the committee, then report back to him what they had on him. Kennedy instructed Chiesty to play along. FBI agents managed to film Chiesty handing committee documents to Hoffa. In exchange, Hoffa handed over an envelope containing $2,000 in cash. At a second meeting, more documents were exchanged, although no money changed hands at that time. But these tapes were damning, and soon after, the FBI swooped in and arrested Hoffa. Hoffa was charged with 3 counts of bribery and conspiracy, for which he faced up to 13 years in prison. Robert Kennedy famously announced to the press that if Hoffa wasn't convicted, "I'll jump off the Capitol dome." Hoffa retained one of the country's top trial lawyers, Edward Bennett, in his defense. During the trial, when Hoffa thought the jury's attention was elsewhere, he glared at Chiesty, the key witness, drawing his finger across his throat in a throat-slitting gesture. Hoffa's lawyer managed to tear apart the government's case. It took the jury less than 4 hours to acquit Hoffa on July 19, 1957, after which Jimmy Hoffa sent Kennedy a toy parachute tagged with a single word, "jump." In August, Hoffa was called once again to testify before the McClellan Committee, but Hoffa either had a pat answer for everything or said he just plain couldn't remember any time questions came up regarding mob ties to the Teamsters. The committee brought up 48 transactions showing Hoffa as profiting at the union's expense. But no matter what the committee threw at him, Hoffa maintained his combative stance and the public loved him for it. Hoffa's public persona became that of an everyman willing to stand up to the U.S. government on behalf of workers. The Teamsters would go on to choose Hoffa as their next president, but by 1955, the Teamsters belonged to the huge labor coalition formed by the merger of the CIO and the American Federation of Labor. The AFL-CIO threatened to boot the Teamsters out of their coalition if they made Hoffa president. Despite this, the Teamsters went ahead and did it anyway, and the AFL-CIO made good on their threat. Hoffa didn't care, though. He was now in charge of one of the largest labor unions in the country, with the freedom to do whatever he wanted. Hoffa went all in on the job. He would often work 18 hours a day, 7 days a week. Chuckie O'Brien was both his companion and bodyguard in many of his trips. Hoffa traveled all over the country, recruiting members, giving speeches, and checking up on union locals. While he was on the road, he invited his fellow Teamsters to call him with any problem, anytime, day or night. And his people loved him for it. When Hoffa sat down at the bargaining table, it was often said that he knew the ins and outs of contracts better than the lawyers did. His energy seemed limitless. His critics said he ran the Teamsters like a dictator. In 1961, Hoffa easily won re-election as Teamsters president. At the convention, there were a few dissenters who tried to speak out against him, but Hoffa took care of them by switching off their microphones. At that same convention, Hoffa moved to change the rules so that all paid officials automatically qualified as convention delegates. This effectively barred the rank and file from attending future conventions. They also dropped the Union Constitution's long-standing ban on allowing convicted racketeers as members. The delegates even agreed to pay all legal fees of officials for any crime, up to and including murder. In addition, the Teamsters voted to exonerate Hoffa and all other union leaders from all the charges that were brought against them by Congress and the courts. In fact, the union had no actual power to do so, but this didn't matter much in the grand scheme of things. With all this freedom in hand to do whatever he wanted, Hoffa began appointing a number of high-ranking mobsters to senior positions in the Teamsters Union. Among these new vice presidents in the union was a captain in the Genovese crime family named Anthony Provenzano, a.k.a. Tony Pro. Provenzano headed up a Teamsters local in New Jersey and also was appointed the chief of the New Jersey Joint Council 73, which allowed him to supervise the majority of locals in the state. Keep in mind that at the time of Tony Pro's elevation to such a high-ranking position in the Teamsters, he was also under indictment for extorting money from a number of New Jersey trucking firms. Police also suspected him of offering sweetheart deals to businesses in exchange for a fee that allowed employers to pay substandard wages. Police were also investigating him for the murder of Anthony Castellito, a New Jersey Teamster who had been critical of Provenzano. Someone smashed Castellito's skull with a hammer. Then he was garroted in addition to that for good measure. But Hoffa and Provenzano had become fast friends in the meantime. It was a financially lucrative relationship for the two of them as well. That is, until the relationship soured, which many investigators came to believe was the ultimate cause for Hoffa's disappearance and presumed murder. In 1964, Hoffa managed to further expand the Teamsters Union by bringing virtually all on-the-road truck drivers in North America under a single National Master Freight Agreement. This is something which many consider to be his biggest achievement in his time as union president. He then tried to bring all airline workers and other transport workers into the union as well, with much more limited success. Hoffa was elected to a third five-year term as president despite having been convicted of jury tampering and mail fraud in court verdicts that were stayed pending review on appeal. But since Hoffa was facing criminal charges, a right-hand man was appointed named Frank Fitzsimmons as his first vice president. It was expected that Fitzsimmons would take the reign as president if Hoffa went to jail. Hoffa would eventually be convicted, but not before stirring up further controversy. After the Senate Select Committee failed to convict him in 1957, the Kennedys stepped up their war against Hoffa. After John F. Kennedy was elected president in 1960, he appointed his younger brother Bobby, Hoffa's arch nemesis, as Attorney General. From that point on, Bobby Kennedy took a hardline stance against organized crime, even setting up a so-called Get Hoffa Squad of special investigators and prosecutors, whose main job was to bring down the Teamsters president. It's often been theorized that in response to the crackdown on organized crime, the mob fought back in the ultimate way possible. On November 22, 1962, President John F. Kennedy was shot and killed in Dallas, Texas. One of the many conspiracy theories surrounding the assassination was that Kennedy was murdered by mafia hitmen. On the night of Kennedy's assassination, Hoffa reportedly stood up on a chair in front of a group of Teamsters and distastefully cheered that he hoped the worms would eat the president's eyes out. In May 1963, Hoffa's seeming invulnerability before the courts ran out. That was when he was indicted for jury tampering in Tennessee, as well as being charged with the attempted bribery of a grand juror during a 1962 conspiracy trial in Nashville. He was convicted on March 4, 1964, and subsequently sentenced to 8 years in prison and a $10,000 fine. While on bail during his appeal, Hoffa was convicted in a second trial in Chicago on one count of conspiracy and three counts of mail and wire fraud for improper use of the Teamsters pension fund, for which he was sentenced to 5 years in prison. Hoffa spent the next 3 years unsuccessfully appealing his 1964 conviction all the way up to the Supreme Court. After that, Hoffa's appeals ran out and he finally began serving his combined 13-year prison sentence on March 7, 1967 at the Lewisburg Federal Penitentiary in Pennsylvania. After Hoffa entered prison, Frank Fitzsimmons was named as acting president of the union. Hoffa planned to run the union from prison through Fitzsimmons. Although Fitzsimmons had long been a Hoffa loyalist, he soon began to distance himself from Hoffa. Fitzsimmons decentralized much of the power structure Hoffa had put in place. He also began handing over even more financial control of the Teamsters pension fund to the mafia. On June 19, 1971, Hoffa was forced to resign as Teamsters president. and on July 9th, Fitzsimmons took over. After that, Hoffa turned to other powerful friends for help. During his time as head of the Teamsters, Hoffa had thrown both financial and political support to the election campaign of Richard Nixon. On December 23, 1971, less than 5 years into his 13-year sentence, Hoffa called in the favor. He was released from prison after President Nixon commuted his sentence to time served. After Hoffa's resignation, he was awarded a $1.75 million lump sum termination benefit by the Teamsters Retirement and Family Protection Plan. This was something that had never been done before in the history of the Teamsters. The union would then go on to endorse Nixon during his presidential re-election bid in 1972. Although Hoffa regained his freedom, the commutation of his sentence stated that he would not be allowed to engage in the direct or indirect management of any labor organization until March 6, 1980. Hoffa insisted that he had never agreed on any such condition. It was suspected that this condition was placed on Hoffa at the special request of the Teamsters, but this was denied by Frank Fitzsimmons. No matter what, though, by 1973, Hoffa was planning on becoming president of the Teamsters Union once again. He sued to invalidate the restriction against him serving as Teamsters president. Hoffa ultimately lost his court battle since the court ruled that Nixon acted within his presidential powers by imposing the restriction. In retrospect, Hoffa would have been better off refusing the pardon and waiting out his term. If he'd only waited a few years longer, he would have received a mandatory parole in 1974 with no restrictions on him after he left prison. But since he'd gone along with the Nixon bargain, now all he could do was point the finger of blame at his former second-in-command, Frank Fitzsimmons, as the rat who had done this to him. Hoffa spent the next 3.5 years attempting to have his jury tampering conviction overturned and the restrictions against him serving in the union lifted. The courts were yet to rule on a suit charging that the ban President Nixon had imposed on him was unconstitutional and the result of a conspiracy between Nixon and Fitzsimmons. At the time, though, Nixon was facing the consequences of a conspiracy of his own making. On August 9, 1974, facing impeachment for his involvement in the Watergate scandal, President Richard Nixon resigned from office. His successor, Gerald Ford, would pardon him on September 8th of that year. By 1975, even though Hoffa had lost some of the support and influence he once had over the Teamsters Union, there were still plenty of members who loved him and wanted to see him back in. He planned on making his comeback at the local level, starting at his local 299 in Detroit. But also by then, many of Hoffa's former friends and allies in organized crime had turned against him, some of whom began adamantly warning him to give up regaining control of the Teamsters, or else he'd regret it. The mob had a lucrative deal going with Frank Fitzsimmons in charge, and they were concerned that with Hoffa back in control, he'd curtail many of their financial dealings. Several of Hoffa's once closest friends and allies in the mob had turned into bitter enemies. This included Tony Provenzano, who had gotten into a dispute with Hoffa in prison over money. Some insiders claim that their relationship began to cool after Provenzano asked Hoffa to find a way to get around a bylaw in the Teamsters Constitution that denied a pension to members convicted of extortion. There weren't any such bylaws against a Teamster convicted of mail fraud or jury tampering, meaning Hoffa was eligible for a pension, but Tony Pro was not. Provenzano thought this was unfair. During their first 4 months in Lewisburg prison together, Hoffa and Provenzano remained fairly civil to one another. In fact, Hoffa likely saved Tony Pro's life. This was after Provenzano began suffering a serious stomach ailment, but the prison authorities seemed reluctant to give the man proper medical attention. Hoffa angrily threatened to go to the press with the story if they didn't help him. Soon after, Provenzano was rushed to a civilian hospital for treatment. Despite this good deed, the relationship between Provenzano and Hoffa grew steadily worse. In August of 1967, the two men almost came to blows during an argument. Reportedly, both men were about to start swinging fists at each other before some of the other inmates dragged them apart. No one knows exactly what it was that the two men said to one another that sparked the argument, but Tony Pro reportedly began shouting threats to Hoffa's life right there and then. Things grew steadily worse from there. Once word got out about the feud between the two men, many of Tony Pro's loyalists in the New Jersey Teamsters abandoned Hoffa. After Provenzano was released from prison, he threatened to kidnap Hoffa's granddaughter and put her eyes out. Provenzano's hatred for Hoffa grew only further after Hoffa struck up a friendship in prison with another powerful mobster named Carmine Galante, who was serving 20 years in Lewisburg prison for a narcotics conviction. The Provenzanos were a member of the Genovese crime family. Galante,
was a sworn enemy who was a member of the rival New York mob family run by Joseph Bonanno. Meanwhile, Hoffa's hold over the Teamsters grew steadily weaker from prison. Frank Fritz Simmons was relishing his cushy position. He had a huge office, a lavish expense account, a $100,000 a year salary, and a private jet at his disposal. At the same time, Fitzsimmons was considered to be lacking in Hoffa's strength and conviction. He pretty much handed over control of the union to the mob while he raked in the profits. Hoffa's dilemma grew even worse when in 1971 a federal parole board denied his petition for release from prison. This despite being a model prisoner and having a sick wife on the outside. Hoffa's wife Josephine had suffered a severe heart attack. Hoffa had only been granted a brief 5-day furlough to visit her in a San Francisco hospital. Hoffa came to realize that if he wanted out, he was going to have to choose between his beloved Teamsters and his freedom. He knew the parole board would not look kindly on him if he sought re-election as Teamsters president from behind bars. So during the next Teamsters convention in July of 1971, Hoffa decided to withdraw his name as a candidate. Soon after, Hoffa resigned all his other union duties as well. At the convention, Hoffa was granted his entire pension as a $1.7 million lump sum. On December 23, 1971, Jimmy Hoffa received his presidential pardon from Richard Nixon and he walked out of Lewisburg prison a free man. At the same time, he was still legally barred from returning to the Teamsters, but Hoffa saw this as just another setback, and Hoffa never backed down from a fight. One mobster whom Jimmy still viewed as a friend was Tony Jack Jackalone. He was the longtime lieutenant of Detroit Mafia Don Joseph Zirilli and the primary mob liaison to the Teamsters. At one point, Hoffa went to Jackalone and asked him to set up a meeting between him and Provenzano, where the two men could bury the hatchet. The meeting was set up for July 30, 1975 at the Marcus Red Fox restaurant in Bloomfield Township. Hoffa was supposed to meet both men for lunch at 2 p.m. that afternoon. Only Jackalone and Provenzano never showed up for the meeting. And in fact, both mobsters later provided police solid alibis for their whereabouts that day. Hoffa was seen growing frustrated, and at one point he was spotted talking to three men driving a maroon Lincoln or Mercury. After which, Hoffa got into the back seat of the car and it drove away. After that, no one ever saw Jimmy Hoffa again. The Conspirators is written and produced by me, Nate Hale, an entirely fictional identity. Thanks so much for listening. This is part one of a special two-part episode on the disappearance of Jimmy Hoffa. In part two, I'll tell you all about some of the major theories surrounding Hoffa's disappearance. In other business, I have some new Patreon supporters to thank. Thank you to Michelle, Lindsay, and Heather for signing up and helping support the show. I couldn't do this without you. And thanks to all my other patrons as well. Just a reminder, the patrons of the show get access to all sorts of nifty bonuses. This includes early, ad-free episode releases, signed note cards from yours truly, stickers, magnets, t-shirts, and of course our ever-growing library of bonus mini-episodes. Right now, you can find a huge collection of short, bite-sized episodes just waiting for you over on Patreon if you subscribe. Another great way you can help the show out is to subscribe and leave us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts. Currently, you can find us at Apple, Spotify, and pretty much everywhere else you get your podcasts. We also have a website, theconspiratorspodcast.com, where you can listen to our back catalog of shows. Elsewhere, I encourage you to check us out on social media. We're on Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, and TikTok. In fact, if you check us out on YouTube, Instagram, and TikTok, you can find that we've been posting short-form videos about some of the same topics we cover here on this podcast. On top of all that, I encourage you to drop us a line and let us know how we're doing by emailing us at theconspiratorspodcast@gmail.com. I love to hear from you. Let us know what you think of the podcast, give us episode suggestions, or anything else you want to share. Thanks again for listening, and I hope you'll join us again next time for part two of our deep dive into the disappearance of Jimmy Hoffa.
Hello, my name is Matt, host of the Pirate History Podcast. Pirates rank among the most mythologized and romanticized of all historical figures. It can become easy to forget that pirates were real people that had real-world concerns. If you like tales of high seas adventure, derring do, and also want to learn more about who Blackbeard supported to be king, you can learn more about all of that at the Pirate History Podcast.